Timing in politics, as in life, is everything. So as Election Day draws near, the Clinton Foundation is getting a closer look-see. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, it is the 22nd of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You got money in politics. You got money and politics. And then you got politics and money and influence. It's that last item with which we begin today, the increasing visibility and pressure that Hillary Clinton finds herself under as a result of the dealings of the Clinton Foundation while she was Secretary of State and now potentially as president. After years of the foundation taking and thriving with foreign donations, former President Bill Clinton announced some changes today. The biggest of them is that if his wife wins, the foundation will only take money from American citizens, permanent residents, and U.S.-based independent foundations. Steve Eder has covered the Clinton Foundation and this year's election for the New York Times. Steve, good to have you with us.
Happy to be here.
Bill Clinton came out today and made some changes with what the Clinton Foundation is going to do. The question has to be, what do you suppose took them so long to realize that this was a big political problem for them?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily something that's brand new. I mean, certainly there's a long history here as you look back on the Clinton Foundation and the political context, you know, where there have been concerns that have been raised about the foundation and how it interacts with donors, how that might affect official business of the Clintons. And these issues have been out there for quite a while. And, you know, now in these final months of the campaign, you know, it appears that the foundation is just trying to announce some things that, you know, will start to show how this might look down the road.
We should say here that there's a new batch of emails out today showing more interacting and coordinating, I suppose, between the foundation staff and Secretary Clinton's staff when she was at the State Department.
Yeah, and this is sort of the latest, you know, in a series of these types of emails that show, you know, interaction with the staff, with overlapping to some extent with the foundation and the State Department. And, you know, when you take all of these together, it has, you know, sort of underscores the issue for the campaign in trying to explain these relationships and explain the work of the foundation, you know, make some sense of something that voters, you know, polling shows that voters are skeptical.
In your reporting, talk to me about some of the red flags that have come up, some of the examples of interactions, donations that might raise some questions.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Well, one of them that's come up recently, you know, was a case of a Lebanese-Nigerian businessman who has quite a few interests around the world, and he had been a contributor in the $1 to $5 million range. And there was a batch of emails that showed how one of the top aides to President Clinton had reached out to a top State Department aide and said, "Hey, this guy, you know, would like to speak with a high level person, and you know, it's an important issue." And you sort of see some of the you know, facilitating of that. It doesn't appear that happened, but you know, that raises that question of, you know, was there preferential special treatment here? What we found out later from the businessman was that, hey, I was just trying to provide some information to the U.S. government related to the Lebanese elections in 2009. But it's things like that that tend to, you know, that have tended to come up where, you know, sort of that overlapping of interests, the overlapping of spheres between foundation and official.
What have the Clintons said? What has the foundation said about Mrs. Clinton's time as Secretary of State and why all of this was okay when she was the nation's top diplomat, but not okay now that she's running for office herself?
Well, I think that there's a couple things, too, that come up here. I mean, when she was Secretary of State, she had came to an agreement. There, you know, this was obviously a concern, very much like it is now, was a concern then. It had come to an agreement that she was going to separate herself from foundation work. That was, you know, highly publicized, discussed at the time. You know, the questions now are being raised about how much separation there really was, and these emails tend to highlight the kinds of things that make the, you know, critics uncomfortable. And also, I mean, look, this has certainly been something that the Clinton campaign has had to contend with, you know, throughout, and from Mr. Trump and others as they wage their way through this.
Steve Eder is an investigative correspondent at the New York Times covering the election this time around. Steve, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Wall Street today could have used some cash, foreign or otherwise. I'm just saying. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The deal of the day this Monday is a drug play. The big pharma conglomerate Pfizer is spending $14 billion to buy Medivation. That's the producer of a drug to treat prostate cancer. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains the acquisition business model.
The drug is called Xtandi, and there are a couple reasons why it's so valuable to Pfizer. One is that Pfizer's earnings could use a booster shot. Michael Levesque is with Moody's.
Large pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer and some of its peers have slower growth outlooks than they used to have, mainly because a lot of their products have already gone generic.
Xtandi's patent won't expire for years. It also helps Pfizer become a power player in the lucrative cancer drug business. What makes it so lucrative? Well, as you can probably guess, there's kind of a captive market, not just of the patients who desperately need it, but also of their insurers.
No insurance company wants to deny coverage of a drug if a patient's going to die for not taking it.
John Palizza is a retired lecturer for Rice University's business school. He was an exec at Walgreens for 23 years. He says another reason Xtandi helps Pfizer is that it's already on the market.
If you can buy something that's already been made by an innovative newer company, you're ahead of the game.
Pfizer's not alone in pursuing these expensive drugs. The pharmaceutical company Sanofi had bid $9 billion for Medivation, an offer that Pfizer beat by more than half. Claire Cruising is a spokeswoman for America's health insurance plans. She says this strategy poses another problem for insurers.
There is, a question and I think a big concern about the consolidation in the pharmaceutical space and what impact that may have on pricing overall.
Bloomberg estimates Xtandi's cost at about $129,000. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Turkey, for the past couple of months, has been preventing refugees from crossing its territory and making it harder for them, therefore, to reach southern Europe. The European Union has offered billions of dollars in aid in return for that and the prospect of visa-free travel to Europe for Turkish citizens. Yesterday, though, EU Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker said the travel deal would only come once Turkey met all the conditions, including reform of some anti-terror laws that the Europeans say have been applied too broadly since last month's failed coup. The Turks say visa-free travel by October, or the deal could be off, which could mean another huge refugee crisis. Marketplace's European correspondent Stephen Beard has the story.
President Erdogan agreed on March 18th to stem the flow of migrants and refugees crossing the Aegean Sea. Joel Millman of the International Organization for Migration says the deal seems to be working.
Around March 20th, we saw an immediate drop-off practically to nothing on this migrant route by sea.
This had been the chaotic scene only days before the deal was done. Another dangerously overladen boat beaches on the Greek island of Lesbos. 10,000 people were arriving every day. After the deal, says Millman, that flood became a trickle.
We rarely see a day now with as many as 100 people. We've had any number of days in the last 4 months with zero arrivals.
But the deal between Erdogan and the EU is now on the rocks, says Michael Volgemuth of the Open Europe think tank in Berlin.
After this failed coup and the post-coup purge in Turkey, it is hard to see how this refugee deal can really succeed.
Under the deal, the EU promised to grant Turks visa-free travel throughout the 28-nation bloc, so long as Turkey agreed to clean up its conduct on human rights. The post-coup crackdown, 17,000 arrests and tens of thousands of people suspended from their jobs, doesn't quite fill that bill, says Volgemuth.
Now what's happening is pretty much the opposite, so I cannot really imagine how this deal could work now.
The EU is expected to withdraw the offer of visa-free travel in October. The deal with Turkey does seem likely then to fall apart. But not everyone would be unhappy to see the EU disengaging from the Erdogan embrace. Turkey's autocratic president has become a target for German satire. This little ditty on German TV so outraged the Turkish leader that he protested formally to the German ambassador. Another satirist responded with another blast of German humor.
Kurden treten, Christen hauen und dabei Kinderpornos schauen.
This poem ludicrously accused Erdogan of having relations with 100 sheep. Erdogan demanded the satirist be prosecuted under an antiquated German law. Controversially, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel authorized the prosecution in principle. Rem Korteweg of the Center for European Reform says the whole migrant deal with Turkey has shown clear signs of European desperation.
There was a mood of panic that these numbers of migrants and refugees making their way across were unsustainable. Something had to be done. And yes, it meant doing a deal with a country that was backsliding on democratic values.
If the deal does collapse, Europe won't necessarily face a new wave of refugees. There are now NATO patrols in the Aegean helping to deter people smugglers. And, says Chris Borowski of the EU's border agency, many countries in the Balkans have closed their borders, sending a clear signal to the migrants.
They now understand that it's basically very difficult to cross, and if you cross, you will not keep moving into Europe.
But if the Turkey-EU deal falls by the wayside, it will be a setback. Countries in the front line are getting nervous. Bulgaria has just ordered another 20 miles of fencing. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So I feel like they're right to be angry, but they're delivering their mail to the wrong address.
Trump voters this election and what they are so angry about. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off a 10th percent today, 23 points, 18,529. The S&P 500 gave back a small fraction of 1%, just a point, basically flat, 2182. The NASDAQ added a 10th, 6 points. 52.44. Pfizer's big deal with Medivation gave biotech stocks a big boost, with Medivation in the lead. The shares soared nearly 20% today. Tesoro, I imagine, advanced 4.25%. Shareholders in Clovis Oncology went home 5% richer today. Big Pharma not so much. Pfizer down 0.4%. In tech, Hewlett Packard, which reports earnings on the hardware side later this week, clicked up 0.25% today. Facebook up 0.5% today as well. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.54%. And you, yes, you. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is a milestone of sorts, the 20th anniversary of welfare reform. Bill Clinton signed the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act into law today in 1996. Earlier this summer, our Wealth and Poverty team launched the first season of their new podcast. It's called The Uncertain Hour, and in it answered this question. 20 years after that reform, what do we know about how welfare works right now? They went out and they talked to women who've been on welfare about the jobs they've had.
Chopping cotton, picking cotton, pulling corn.
Oh, gosh. It's been mostly minimum wage jobs. Gas stations.
Village Liquor.
Sprint.
Walmart.
Working for Tyson's down in North Carolina. And, oh, my God, all that raw chicken. You could actually smell the kill.
And they tracked down some of the lesser-known people behind welfare reform, like this guy. His name is Larry Townsend.
We're not going to train you for years. We're not going to send you to school for years. We're going to show you how to find a job.
Townsend's philosophy became, in some ways, the national blueprint. Require welfare recipients to find a job, any job. And, in fact, with the new law came work requirements and time limits for assistance. Welfare, as we know it now, is federal block grants to states, straight up cash that the states get to decide how to spend. Luke Schaefer is at the University of Michigan School of Social Work.
If you don't use the money for cash assistance, you can use it for pretty much anything else. There's virtually no oversight.
There are some restrictions, but the money has been used in some surprising ways. Marriage counseling, college scholarships, crisis pregnancy centers. One last thing that fans of our podcast already know. One county welfare office produced an album of motivational songs about work right at the height of the debate over welfare reform. We're releasing that whole album today, all 10 songs. Apologies in advance if you can't get them out of your head. You can find it at our website, marketplace.org/The Uncertain Hour. You can also go wherever you like to subscribe to the podcast. It is called, once again, The Uncertain Hour. I'm going to go not so far out on a limb here and say that it sure appears, based on his rallies and the kinds of things his supporters say on camera and on tape and on social media, that a lot of likely Donald Trump voters are angry. A lot of them are men, and most of them are white. Back in 2013, Michael Kimmel, he's a professor of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University, wrote a book called Angry White Men. He talked to hundreds of them, the white supremacists, men's rights activists, and others, to find out what is making them so mad. Dr. Kimmel, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you, Kai.
Who are these men, and what are they angry at?
Well, some of the polls now about some of the angry white men followers of Donald Trump suggest that he does best with small-town, non-college-educated white men and women. But these are also, I think, people who are in industries that have been the most transformed over the past couple of decades. Steel workers, auto workers, the men who are angriest are men who brought up feeling that they were entitled to be a breadwinner, to own their own home. These are guys who basically bought into the American dream circa Don Draper.
The phrase you have come up with from your book is aggrieved entitlement. They believe they were owed. They believe they were due these things.
Well, in many ways, I'm really quite empathetic with them. They believe that if they played by all the rules, paid their taxes, went to work every day, then they should have these benefits at the end. And they don't. So they're furious.
So they are... understandably, I suppose you might say, angry. Question is, though, who are they angry at? Where do they seek redress?
Well, that, to me, I think, having talked to several hundred of these guys, whether at Tea Party rallies earlier on, or some on the extreme right, white supremacists and white nationalists, I realized that they were right to be angry. They've been badly done by. But what I wanted to say to them, of course, as an interviewer, I don't get to say, like, here's my opinion. But, you know, what I wanted to say was, do you really think that it was immigrants who issued those predatory loans that forced you to sell your house or leave it in the middle of the night? Do you think it was feminist women who are responsible for climate change? Do you think it was LGBT people who outsourced your job? So I feel like they're right to be angry, but they're delivering their mail to the wrong address.
And along then comes Donald Trump.
The biggest surprise to me, I wrote my book, Angry White Men. It came out in 2013, yeah. And it's all about these guys. The name Donald Trump does not appear in the book, Kai. It is a book about all of his followers who I believe were really kind of waiting for their leader to show up. And here he is.
Is it any surprise that his message then resonates so deeply with so many people?
I don't think so at all. I think it's very, very understandable that his message resonates so deeply. In fact, deeply enough that it is sometimes an unconscious resonance. They're not really sure why it feels so right to be angry, but boy, it sure does. And I think that, you know, some of the bewildering changes that have taken place in our country, the fact that a woman is running following the very first African-American president, you know, who instituted health care and same-sex marriage. And as I said, these changes are so bewildering and so fast that I think that it just sort of gives a voice to all of this inchoate anger that had been, you know, sort of simmering just below the surface.
Is this just, you know, to the election news of the week in the next, 3 months or whatever it is this a demographic that it will be dispositive in an election? Can it tip an election?
No. I really do think, based on what I can, you know, what demographic information I can pick up, this is an increasingly loud and numerically declining number of people in our country. Most people are getting on board, out of necessity perhaps, not out of choice, but getting on board with globalization and the kind of neoliberal economic shifts that have taken place around the world. These are the last resistors on the right.
The progressive response has to be get on board or get out of the way. We will leave you behind, right?
No. I think what the case progressives need to make to these angry white men is there are many people who are in the same situation as you are. Nativism has rarely been the way that we could move ahead. And nativist movements are always followed by quite progressive movements. I do think that there is a kind of a general arc of history that says this is the class over which history is about to roll. You know, one idea is, you know, get out of the way or you'll be crushed. The other way is say, come along and we can ride this wave.
Michael Kimmel is at Stony Brook University. His book from a couple of years ago, which turns out to have been remarkably prescient, is called Angry White Men. Professor, thanks very much.
Nice to talk to you, Kai.
Much as I love this job, there are days I doubt myself, like today, when I get stuck fronting a story about the business of sandcastles, and Marketplace's Andy Euler gets to go to the beach in Del Mar, just north of San Diego.
I'm at the Torres family right next to Lifeguard Tower 15. Leonard and Renee brought their four daughters, ages 4, 6, 8, and 11, from New Mexico to take a sandcastle building class. That's right. JT Estrella, the owner of San Diego Sandcastles, starts by showing the kids how to use a plastic mold.
So the whole secret, you have to pack the sand in there, like really tight. Flip it over, and you kind of give it like this little twisty twist, like that, to get it to slide out. See, I got all the pieces right there.
I asked the oldest daughter, Kylie, to show me how to do it.
Well, for the bottom, you got to pat it in real good in there so you can get the shape. Then for the top, pack it real good in there. Then you tip it over, and then you give it a little jiggle, and then pull it off slightly, and then there you go.
Ted Siebert's been making sand art for about 30 years. He even wrote a book called The Art of Sandcastling.
It's the simplest toy or building blocks there is.
4-year-old Myla Torres gets it. She and her mom get lost in the animal molds.
Look, there's even a turtle.
There's even a turtle, yay!
Mark Barnes owns Saugatuck Drugstore on Lake Michigan, where a lot of folks from Chicago and Detroit spend their summers. The store's been around 103 years. He says it used to be the only place you could get sandcastle molds in the area. Now you can get them at Walmart or online.
Before that became, you know, more of an issue, these portable sandcastle molds were, I mean, they were popular for us. You know, we would restock them nearly every single day.
Robin Leonard works at Hoppay, a German educational toy company that 5 years ago started making intricate sandcastle molds. She remembers back in the 60s when kids were building sandcastles with metal tools.
But of course, metal buckets and molds and things like that always have that crease. They can't bend. They don't have the ability to, you know, have those fine details about them. And so, of course, plastic allows us to do that.
Hoppay now has offices in Florida and Canada. The sandcastle molds they sell are produced at a factory in China. In fact, all the toy distributors I spoke with work with Chinese factories to produce their molds. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Kanye West and McDonald's. Let me explain. Frank Ocean released his new album the other day, as you might have heard. Along with it, a zine, in which, first of all, zines are back, but in which the aforementioned Mr. West wrote a poem. It's called The McDonald's Man. Here's a verse or two because it is awesome. Here we go. McDonald's man, the French fries had a plan, the French fries had a plan. The salad bar and the ketchup made a band because the French fries had a plan. The French fries had a plan, McDonald's man, McDonald's. Them French fries look good, though. I knew the Diet Coke was jealous of the French fries. I knew the McNuggets was jealous of the French fries. Even the McRib was jealous of the fries. I could see it through his artificial meat eyes. And he only be there some of the time. Everybody was jealous of them French fries, except for that one special guy, that smooth apple pie. McDonald's man, McDonald's. Pretty good, right? All right, we got to go. The Dow off a 10th percent today, 23 points. The S&P 500 gave back a small fraction of 1%, not even going to acknowledge that. The NASDAQ added a 10th percent, 6 points. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Robert Gurova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. See you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.